Hello, everyone. This is Mary Lou Fabo from Scholar Abbott. It's about 5 minutes to noon, and we are just testing the audio at this point. So if you can hear me, we've got several attendees. Just someone give me a thumbs up.
And this is Amelia Holstrom, too. I want to test and make sure my audio is working. So if you could just give a, let's try thumbs down for that one so we can tell different. Perfect.
Okay, we've got both thumbs up and thumbs down. So we'll be starting in just a few minutes. Thank you.
Okay, everyone. We are going to get started on our webinar because it is 12 o'clock. I know that some people are still joining us, so we'll, you know, get started with some introductions. So first, this is Amelia Holstrom. I am joined by my colleague, Mary Lou Fabo, and today we are going to be talking about the Families First Coronavirus Response Act, or FFCRA for short. Just to answer a few of the questions kind of out of the chute here, the slides are going to be available and will be emailed to registered attendees after the webinar today. Also, we will be taking questions. However, we're going to ask that you try to refrain from asking them until the end of the PowerPoint. If you think you might forget something, feel free to throw it in that chat bubble, and we will try to get to it, but we don't want it to get buried too far in there. And we're going to go over a lot of the kind of common questions we've been getting, because as you can imagine, we've kind of been living and breathing this for the last at least week now. So those will be covered in the webinar, but we understand people may have specific questions that we do not. So feel free to ask us those at the end. Our goal is to have hopefully 10 minutes for questions. We'll see how that goes, but we can also potentially take questions later as well or stay on a little bit past one. So it's possible that we won't get to all of your questions, but we will do our best to do that. So as I've said, we've been kind of living and breathing this new law for the last week here at Scholar Abbott and really digesting it. For those of you who get our client alerts, you know that we issued one yesterday because the Department of Labor has been very active and has issued some employer guidance and also some a question and answers page that did answer some questions and also raised some more questions, and we will talk about those issues today. So before I turn it over to Mary Lou to go through the paid sick leave parts of this law, I just wanted to let you know that you have our contact information on the second and third slide here. So if you need us, that's where you can reach us. And just kind of a general introduction, I'm sure that you all are well aware of this new statute, but it has really two provisions in it that employers need to be aware of. There is a new paid sick leave provision, which is above what sick leave employees already get, and Mary Lou will be covering that. And then there is an expanded emergency FMLA that employees can take as well, and I will be talking about that in the second half of the presentation. So I'm going to turn it over to Mary Lou.
Hello, everyone. I'm Mary Lou Favo. I'm a shareholder here at Scholar Abbott, and as Amelia said, I'm going to begin with information on the sick leave portion of the Families First Coronavirus Response Act. So if you see on the first slide, the act is actually going to be effective April 1st, 2020. I think most of us were going under the belief that it was going to go into effect April 2nd, but what the act itself said is it has to become effective within 15 days of the time that it was enacted, and I think everyone just added 15 days onto that date, and it came to April 2nd. But we learned yesterday that it is going to, in fact, be effective April 1st. I'm going to provide you with the emergency paid sick leave overview, and including addressing some open questions that were answered by the Department of Labor earlier this week. There's many other components to this Families First Act, and they're not related to employment, so we aren't going to be touching on them. I believe that what we go through is going to cover a lot of the common questions, and I know some questions are popping up, and to the extent I can, I will incorporate those questions or the answers to those questions in my materials. Also, today we're focusing entirely on this Families First Act, but we will have a continuing series. This is our second series, our second webinar related to the coronavirus issues in the workplace, and we will be having another one next week. If you have any particular topics you'd like to be covered, you can certainly email suggestions along. I know some attorneys at Scholar Abbott are putting together materials already. Okay, so I'm going to start with probably the most recent development. As you may be aware, the employers are required to post information about these laws under at their workplace or, you know, provide notice to their employees. So to the extent that you do still have a physical workplace that's in operation or you have people going to a physical workplace, you can post this poster, and we've provided the link. It's on the Department of Labor website. You can post it in a conspicuous place at your workplace. But if you don't, if you have everyone working remotely, it's fine to email or direct mail or just to post it on your website, either internally or externally. So you need to do that by April 1st, and the sample is right online. Now, getting into the Act, I'm going to begin with a discussion of who's really covered under these statutes. So, you know, in a lot of cases, the threshold is a certain number of employees and up are covered for a statute. But in this case, it is the law is applicable to employers of fewer than 500 employees. So who do you count? Well, first of all, you stick to employees that are in the United States, D.C., and all of the United States territories and possessions. And as far as individuals in those areas, I've listed the groups of people that you would count, and that includes full and part-time employees, including your employees who may be on a leave of absence, maybe under the FMLA, maybe under ADA-related leave or some other sort of leave. You count those people as well. And you also need to count temporary employees that are jointly employed by your organization and the payroll or the temporary agency if there's a joint employer relationship. That is a very specific inquiry as to whether the two organizations are jointly employed. So if you are in that situation where you are close to the threshold and you want to know whether or not you should count your temps, that's something you should probably consult with your attorney to get into an analysis of whether there could be a joint employment situation. Now, I'm going to caution you a couple issues. If you, for purposes of the statute, decide to represent yourselves as the agency and the temporary placement agency and the employer as joint employers, then the client company and the temporary agency may be seen as joint employers going forward for other purposes, such as, for example, 6 months from now, an employee sues you or a temporary employee sues you, the client company, for sexual harassment. If you've established that you have a joint employment relationship, the temp agency could also be held liable or vice versa if they bring a lawsuit or a charge of discrimination against the temporary placement agency. If you've established that you're a joint employer, you might be held to be a joint employer for those purposes also. Also included in the count of whether there's fewer than 500 employees, the day laborers. So if you have people that just come to your organization on an as-needed or day-by-day basis, you would count them. If there is some sort of ongoing relationship, the group that you do not include are true independent contractors as defined under the Fair Labor Standards Act. So what about corporations? We've gotten some questions about, you know, if you have different divisions, do you count them if they're not located near you? The question and answer provided by the Department of Labor said, yes, we're going to count separate establishments and divisions as a single employer. However, if a corporation actually owns another corporation, the two are going to be considered separate employers unless they are considered joint employers under the FLSA with respect to certain employees. Now, make sure that, again, whether or not an organization is a joint employer or it's a single or integrated enterprise is a very fact-specific test. So you need to, again, be careful about whether you're going to take the position now or make a strong argument that you are a single separate enterprise so that you can reach the 500 employee threshold or be below it, I guess, depending on what your goal is, that you might be bound to that same interpretation later. So it is very fact specific. And again, if you need information on whether or not you could be considered a joint employer or anything of that nature, an integrated employer, then you really need to look at it on a fact-by-fact basis and consult with an attorney. Okay. On a positive note, you have a 30-day no-fault sort of situation here. The Department of Labor has stated that it will not enforce the Act if in the first 30 days if you as the employer acted reasonably and in good faith to comply with the act. And I think by listening to these webinars and paying attention to the situation, that will factor into how the DOL perceives your behavior. So they've decided that good, or they've outlined that good faith exists when the violations aren't willful. So you can't intentionally look the other way or violate the act when you know what you're supposed to be doing. When the violation is actually remedied, when the employer makes an employee whole as soon as practicable. So if the employer makes an error and they discover it, they correct the situation ASAP. And on top of it, the Department of Labor has to receive written communication, a written commitment from the employer that they will comply going forward. So you will not be subject to DOL issues if in the next 30 days anyway you have a good faith effort to comply with the act and you're acting reasonably. Unfortunately, this doesn't have any impact on private litigation. There is no waiting period before you could potentially be liable for a violation. The emergency paid sick leave legal liability really comes out of two different areas. First of all, you can't take a negative personnel action or discriminated against an employee because they've taken leave under the act or because they've filed a complaint or participated in a proceeding under the act. And obviously you would be liable or you could be liable as well if you violate the act's requirements. So I'm going to give you an overview of the important things that you need to know, and then I'm going to break them down. So first of all, what's available in terms of sick leave? Well, a full-time employee will receive up to 80 hours of paid sick leave. A part-time employee will receive a reduced amount, and I'm going to explain how you calculate what the part-time employee will be eligible for. All employees are eligible on day one, so there's no waiting period, and when we talk about the FMLA extension, you'll see that there is a waiting period. Pay is either going to be at 100% of the employee's regular rate or two-thirds of the employee's regular rate, and that's going to depend on the reason for the leave, and I'll break that down. And although there's 100% or two-thirds requirement, there are actually caps on the daily and total payouts. Finally, the emergency paid sick leave is something that employee can take this leave before any other sick time is available to him or her. So if the employee meets one of the qualifying reasons, they have the ability to take this first. You cannot require them to take sick time under your policy or some other sort of paid time off before they use this sick leave. Okay, so there's three reasons. As I mentioned, an employer must pay 100% of the employee's regular rate up to 80 hours, and a little bit different for part-time, but I'm going to talk about that, for three reasons. And these are the three reasons that an employee is eligible for 100% of the regular rate. If the employee is subject to a governmental quarantine or isolation order related to COVID-19. If the employee is advised by a healthcare provider to self-quarantine because of COVID-19, or if the employee is experiencing symptoms of COVID-19 and is seeking medical diagnosis. So, with respect to the first reason, there's been a lot of debate and discussion about whether this first reason, whether Governor Baker's order would fall within this first reason. Does Governor Baker's order, is it a governmental quarantine or isolation order related to the COVID-19? The majority of individuals, including most of us, or maybe all of us at our law firm, believe that it does not apply to that situation because his order is addressed to businesses, while the intent of, we believe, the paid sick leave is focused on an individual. So what do I mean by that? When would number one come into play? So, for example, if an individual is instructed by the government to quarantine because they've been out of the country, we believe that is when factor number one would come into play. So when a state, local, or federal government has addressed an individual situation. Unfortunately, there's no guidelines or regulations on what that actually means at that time, which is going to be true of a lot of these factors, and we're hoping that the regulations are out soon so we can assist employers more fully before the start date. But we are giving you what we believe is our best opinion and based on all the information we've received from a variety of sources. Number two, now I've gotten questions about employees who just want to stay home because they feel they're concerned about being in the workplace, whatever it may be, because of their own personal choice. They would not qualify for emergency paid sick leave unless the employee is advised by a healthcare provider to self-quarantine. So it's not simply because the employee feels safer staying home. And the final reason, the employee may be experiencing symptoms. But, it's not just the employee experiencing symptoms. They also have to be seeking a medical diagnosis. So for each of these reasons, qualifying reasons, the employee is entitled to 100% of their regular rate, but every day their max is $511. So if you have a higher paid employee, the employee may max out, as well as the entitled 80 hours, an employer is not required to pay more than $5,110. I'm moving on now to the other three reasons that someone may take emergency sick leave. And in these situations, an employee is only entitled to 2/3 of their regular rate of pay. So we talked about the other three, 100%. Here we have 2/3 of the pay. So I'm going to address your attention to the bottom of this slide. Again, this is a situation where an employee is going to max out at a dollar amount of $200 per day. So if 2/3 of their pay is more than $200 per day, the employer is only responsible for paying the $200 and $2,000 in total for the entire period. These three reasons. Number one, if you are an employee caring for an individual who's subject to a quarantine or isolation order, or who has been advised by a health care provider to self-quarantine. And what I mean by that is you're caring for someone who's subject to an order, or you're caring for someone who's been advised by a health care provider to self-quarantine because of COVID-19. So that's 2/3 of the employee's regular rate of pay if they qualify for that reason. Number two is the what we've heard a lot about is when an employee needs to stay home. And let me point out, too, this if an employee can work remotely, none of these reasons for receiving pay or this time off is available to them. So these only apply to employees who can't work at the workplace or remotely. If an employee is caring for a child whose school or place of care is closed, or if they have a child care provider who comes to the house or whatever it may be, and that person is unavailable due to the pandemic, then an employee may be paid up to two-thirds of their regular rate. And I've highlighted this because this is also the only reason that someone can take extended FMLA. And Amelia is going to get into that. This is the only new reason under the FMLA. And third, an employee is experiencing substantially similar conditions as specified by federal agencies that we haven't really been given any guidance onto what that might mean. And so, I'm hoping more comes down the road in the near future, but that's what we have for right now. So as I've mentioned, you either have to pay in some circumstances 100% of a regular rate or 2/3 of a regular rate. So what is the regular rate? For a lot of you, you probably are familiar with the regular rate because you're using it upon which to base overtime. Regular rate obviously can't be lower than minimum wage, but it doesn't include overtime. It includes commissions, tips, and piece rates. So what that means is you are looking at the employee's work week and calculating what the rate is that you would be using for overtime purposes. So that includes their hourly rate and any additional compensation they can, they do receive during the week, such as maybe a bonus. They receive a bonus at the end of the month if they've met certain goals. That would be factored into the regular rate. Now, as I mentioned, full-time employees are eligible for 80 hours of this time for one of these six reasons. But part-time employees are only entitled to what the employee would work on an average over a two-week period. So, again, they're eligible for fewer than 80 total hours. So, for a part-time employee, you calculate leave based on the number of hours the employee is regularly scheduled to work per week. And I will give you some examples in the next slide. So if an employee works 10 hours a week, that's a simple calculation. If the time varies that they work 12 hours one week and maybe 20 the next week, then you're going to use a six-month average of hours to determine how many hours they work per week. If the employee hasn't been employed for at least 6 months, you're going to use the number of hours that you and the employee agreed upon or discussed upon hiring that the employee would work. But if there was no discussion, it was open-ended, then you would calculate the number of hours of leave based on the average hours the employee was scheduled to work over the entire term of employment. So you're looking for an average, and if the part-time employee doesn't have some kind of standard schedule or regular numbers of hour per week, you're going to have to go back for a longer time period to determine how many hours the employee is going to have worked for this time period. So an employee who is regularly, a part-time employee who is regularly scheduled to work for 15 hours a week, they would be eligible for 30 total hours of earned sick leave. Instead of 40 hours per week, they would get their work week, which is 15, for 2 weeks. If the employee's weekly hours vary, but the average hours per week are 18, the employee would be eligible for 36 hours. So what you need to determine is how many hours the, how many hours the less than full-time employee works on average per week, and then multiply it by two. And that's the amount that that employee would get. They would not get the full 80 hours. Suggested documentation. We recommend, and there's been some language, that employers should not be as insistent on documentation as they have been with respect to other types of leave, such as, you know, regular FMLA leave. But in terms of school or daycare reasons, the employee cannot work either in the office or remotely. They have kids at home, and there's just no way to do work at home because they're caring for their children. As far as school goes or the daycare, you might have an email, a public announcement, some statement that the daycare is not open, and maybe in other circumstances, it would be sufficient for an employee to provide you with a verified statement that they have no child care. If the person is not working or unable to work at home or remotely because of the quarantine or isolation, then that order should suffice. And also, when it's related to a health condition, we're recommending a no, a letter, an email from a healthcare provider regarding the employee if the employee is staying home for their own issue or related to their family member, something about the family member. Now, again, you know, we're being encouraged not to visit healthcare providers, so maybe a lot of this will be done by electronic, some kind of telehealth communication, or employers simply taking their employees' word for it and erring on the side of over-providing the leave. I'm going to turn this over to Amelia. I just want to mention one thing. We've gotten several questions if the slides will be available. And Amelia addressed that early on, and I know some people joined afterwards. But, yes, we will be emailing the slides or making them available after the end of the presentation. And there's one other thing I wanted to touch on, too, is these laws apply to leaves that happen between April 1st and December 31st. So if you've already generously provided time off, you do not get to credit that against what your obligations are under the expanded FMLA or the emergency sick leave. And with that, I will turn it over to Amelia.
Thanks, Mary Lou. I did want to address one more question that I saw that someone had. It's difficult to keep up with these things when you're presenting. So I saw that someone was asking if you could force an employee to use their other paid time off before they get this emergency sick leave. The statute expressly says that you cannot force an employee to do that. So they get this if they request it. So turning to the expanded FMLA, as Mary Lou said, this is also for leaves between April 1st and December 31st of 2020. The leave is going to sunset on December 31st, 2020, unless there is some type of extension. I'm not implying we have heard that will happen, but it is always possible. It entitles people to 12 weeks of FMLA leave for a public health emergency for a single reason, which we will get to in a minute. This is an amendment to the current FMLA law. So it's tricky for employers to follow, but regular FMLA is still in place. So regular FMLA is for birth of a child, your own serious health condition, to care for someone with a serious health condition. And it is quite possible that caring for someone who has COVID-19 or having it yourself is going to be a serious health condition that will qualify you for regular FMLA. And all of the regular FMLA rules remain in place. That means that it is unpaid, that you have to look at whether they have worked 1,250 hours in the previous 12-month period, and that they have worked 12 months for you. Remember, those months don't have to be consecutive. There are break-in service rules. But that is all still in place. So we also don't think that this gives an employee an extra 12 weeks of leave. Based on our current belief, and it's possible the DOL will come out with some sort of regulation about this, but as we currently read the statute, we believe that if someone has already used their 12 weeks of FMLA or a portion of their FMLA in the leave year that you use as an employer, they do not now get 12 more weeks. So if someone used 8 weeks for the birth of a child, in your leave year, they would have 4 more weeks to take for this new FMLA reason due to a public emergency, which we will be getting to. Similar to what Mary Lou talked about, this is the same covered employer test. So it applies to employers with fewer than 500 employees. And two tests apply to whether related entities will be counted together or not. The joint employer test that Mary Lou talked about earlier, and that's the test where you can count the employees who are jointly employed only. And then there's a test where related entities who meet 4 factors can count all the employees at both, and there has to be a interrelation of operations, there has to be centralized labor control, a degree of control exercised, and there is one other factor, which I am not recalling off the top of my head, but it is a very specific analysis. The fourth factor is common management, but it is a very specific analysis, and if you think that you may meet that test, you should be sure to consult with Labor and Employment Council about that and make sure that it is being applied correctly. That being said, as Mary Lou warned, I want to warn again, if you make the argument that you have joint employees with another employer or you're an integrated employer to get over this 500 threshold, remember that that may impact you in the long run for other things like aggregating hours for paying overtime, and you want to make sure you're not taking a position contrary to what you have taken before, simply because you want to try to stretch above this now. You should, keep that in mind. And also, it could have other implications, but have your Labor and Employment Council look at it and make sure that you are applying the tests correctly. So like Mary Lou said, with the paid sick leave provision of this law, their employees are eligible on their first day of employment with you. Right away, it is immediate. But with the family and medical leave provision, which again can be taken for a single reason, someone has to be on the payroll for 30 calendar days immediately prior to the day the leave would begin. And the DOL issued some guidance yesterday about when you count this 500 employees. And they said that is on the day that the leave is to begin. So it is really a snapshot in time. So it is possible that in April you may not you may be above the 500 threshold, but you may come down below it and then be covered by this law sometime before December 31st or vice versa. If an employee is a temporary employee and you subsequently hire that employee, you have to include the time the person worked as a temporary employee for determining the 30 calendar days of employment. Again, remember that this is for the one single new reason under the FMLA. The old FMLA rules apply to all the old reasons that you could take FMLA, such as a serious health condition and a birth of a child. So under this new portion of the law, the only new reason that someone can take emergency FMLA is if the employee is unable to work or telework due to a need for leave to care for a son or daughter under 18 if school is closed, daycare is closed, or if a child provider is unavailable due to COVID-19. This should sound familiar because it was one of the reasons that someone can also take paid sick leave under this new statute. And we will talk about how those leaves are going to work and what a person can ultimately take or what we think they can take based on the language of the statute and how they will interact with one another throughout the webinar. So this is the sole reason. And remember that it has to be due to a public health emergency. So that is defined under the statute as an emergency with respect to COVID-19 declared by a federal, state, or local authority. I think most of the states at this point have declared a public health emergency, so that really doesn't come into play. But it may further down the line as this law moves towards December 31st of 2020. So how does the pay work under the emergency FMLA? Like the paid sick leave, there are pay requirements under the statute. And again, it's for that single reason that they are taking the leave, which is your child care provider is unavailable or the school is closed and they can't work or telework. The first 10 days of it are unpaid. And an employee can elect to use any accrued vacation, personal or sick leave, but you can't, including the new paid sick leave that Mary Lou just talked about, but you cannot force them to use that. So they can elect to do it. For the rest of the leave, which is up to 10 more weeks, and I want to remind people that this is work weeks, just like the classic FMLA, so that rule still applies. It is work weeks. It's not as if someone is getting 12 weeks based on 7 days a week or 5 days a week. It's really driven by what their individual work week looks like. So I want employers to remember that. But for the rest of that 10 weeks of leave, employees who have regularly scheduled hours will be paid 2/3 their regular rate of pay based on the hours they are regularly scheduled to work. However, if an employee has varying hours, sort of just like the paid sick leave, you are going to calculate an average number of hours they're scheduled per day during the 6 months preceding the date of the leave. If an employee didn't work for you for at least 6 months, you're supposed to use the number of hours agreed upon at the time of hire. And if there's no agreement, use appropriate number of hours based average per day the employee was scheduled to work during the entire period of employment. This is like the paid sick leave in terms of caps on pay. So employees are going to be capped at $200 per day. That's what they have to be paid. So if they're two-thirds of their regular rate is above that, you only have to pay them $200 up to an aggregate of $10,000. So you will not be paying employees more than $10,000 under this provision of the leave. When they're on leave, you're going to pay them for the hours that they miss at the regular rate that you have calculated, including any scheduled hours of overtime that the person had. But the DOL regulations made clear that there would be no premium pay for those scheduled overtime hours. It's just two-thirds of their regular rate of pay. There is, as I said, and as Mary Lou said, some overlap between the paid sick leave and the emergency FMLA leave. So that overlap is leave to care for your child whose school is closed or place of daycare is closed or the child care provider is unavailable due to COVID-19. I did see yesterday, because I have kids in daycare, that Governor Baker has closed all non-emergency daycares until May 4th and all schools in Massachusetts. And I think the language he used was until at least May 4th. So it may be even longer than that. So keep that in mind when employees are requesting this leave. So as I said, the emergency FMLA, or eFMLA for short, is available to those who have worked 30 days and who haven't already used up all of their FMLA time in the leave year that you use as an employer. But the earned sick leave is going to be available immediately. So the day you hire someone, they are entitled to that 80 hours if they're full-time, or the average over their 2 work weeks if they are part-time. They are entitled to that time immediately. For an employee who is eligible for emergency family and medical leave, as I said, during those first 2 weeks, there is no pay, but they can choose to use emergency sick leave pay or substitute any other accrued unused leave that they have under your other policies. And if they substitute their earned sick leave, remember, as Mary Lou talked about, for those first 2 weeks, they would be getting paid two-thirds of their pay up to a max of $200 a week or $2,000 in the aggregate over those first 2 weeks. When that happens, their leave time is running concurrently. So if someone requests FMLA leave and during those first 2 weeks they want to use their emergency paid sick leave to receive pay, the time runs concurrently under that. Then when you turn to the next weeks, 3 to 12, if they still have 12 weeks available, again, if they've already taken some FMLA leave, they are going to have less than that. They will receive their two-thirds pay up to a max of $200 a day or $10,000 in the aggregate. The total an employee can be paid for all of this time is $200 a day up to those number of weeks, which is 12 weeks, so it's $12,000. So that is the total that an employee can get paid. That's what they cap out at. I have seen a lot of questions about whether employees can use this leave intermittently or not. We think that because the classic FMLA definitions are still exist and were not amended by the statute, that it is going to be the DOL's position and plaintiff's lawyers everywhere as well, that employees can use this on an intermittent basis or a reduced schedule basis. And you may be thinking, well, why would they need that? And with spouses working remotely and splitting time at home, I think that it is perfectly possible that someone will either say, well, I'm going to watch my kids Monday, Wednesday, Friday, so I need 3 days of leave, and my partner or spouse is going to watch my kids on Tuesday and Thursday, or I have a sitter on some days and not others. So I think employees may be asking to use this on a reduced schedule or intermittent basis, and we think that they will be able to do that. a little bit about the last part about employees getting 12 weeks of paid leave. As I said, if they ask to use FMLA leave and they say they want to get paid that first 2 weeks and use their emergency paid sick leave, the time runs concurrently. The bigger question I have been getting is if someone comes to me and says, I want to take my emergency FMLA leave for 12 weeks, they qualify, you give them that leave, but they choose not to be paid those first 2 weeks, we think they can actually get 14 weeks of leave. So they could take 2 weeks of unpaid FMLA leave for that qualifying reason. They could then take 10 weeks where they would be paid at 2/3 up to the subject caps. And then they would still have their up to 80 hours of paid sick leave left that they could use thereafter. But the total pay they can receive is 12 weeks. We have also been being asked if someone says that they want to use their paid sick leave, but they don't express for 2 weeks, but they don't expressly refer to the FMLA statute or the need for emergency FMLA, but it is also a qualifying reason under the emergency FMLA. We believe that you may be able to auto-designate that leave as FMLA leave. That is articulated in the current regulations, but again, we expect some regulations from the DOL, which employers about this emergency FMLA leave, which employers should pay careful attention to, because that may change some of these opinions. But that's based on our current belief of how things are going to work as well. And I did see a question pop up earlier is, what if I use my paid sick leave for one of the non-childcare reasons? So you are subject to an isolation order from a federal government, and you use your 2 weeks of sick leave for that. Those employees would then still be eligible for 12 weeks of FMLA leave for the qualifying FMLA reason. And that's, or the qualifying FMLA reason under this Emergency Paid Sick Leave Act. So employers should be aware of that, and also make sure that you are sending FMLA paperwork if you are covered by the regular FMLA, because if someone has COVID-19, it's a serious health condition. So a little bit more about how these relate. You should remember that for an employee who is not eligible for emergency FMLA leave, maybe they haven't been employed long enough, they've used up all of their FMLA time on something else earlier in your benefit year that they use, they can still get the emergency sick leave up to a total of 80 hours at 2/3 pay, up to those caps that Mary Lou talked about. So one thing I did want to address that has come up that we don't really know how it's going to work. Some employers who employ two spouses have asked if they can require spouses to split this new time. We don't know the answer to that. We're hoping that will be clarified in the DOL regulations, but I would not hold my breath about that. I also wanted to mention, while I am thinking of it, is I referenced that the DOL came out with some guidance yesterday. So there's employer guidance, there's some questions and answers, there's also a fact sheet for employees as well. Those address a number of issues, but notably, in a footnote on the bottom of the fact sheets, the DOL says that the regulations that are going to come out, or hopefully come out, are expected in April 2020. And since the law goes live on April 1st, it is quite possible that the law will be in effect and employers will be navigating this before the regulations come out. Or at least they may appear on April 1st, and employers will be kind of scrambling to digest them. As soon as we see those regulations, we will make sure that we have an e-alert out to our clients about what is in them, because they're going to be very important for you to know. So what is also important is that the Secretary of Labor can issue regulations as outlined in the statute for two specific issues. It doesn't say that they have to issue regulations, by the way, but it is anticipated that they will do this. So they can exclude certain healthcare providers and emergency first responders from the definition of eligible employee. And what the statute says is that you can exclude such employees. So employers, healthcare employers, are hoping that the DOL regulations will clarify that and say that, you know, hospitals and doctor's offices and places that are typical healthcare providers will be able to exclude their entire workforce. But as the statute is currently written, it leaves that, it looks like that will not be the case. So it says that employers of healthcare providers can exclude such employee, which based on that interpretation, if it stands and the DOL doesn't help, looks like it may be an individual analysis for each of your employees. So your schedulers may not be healthcare providers, and so those people you would not be excluded by the DOL. And we'll talk a little bit more about this later as well. So to exempt businesses, they can also exempt businesses with fewer than 50 employees from two pieces of this. They can exempt them from the expanded FMLA, so that FMLA needed to care for your child, and the sick leave for child care. Those are the only two reasons. So the other five sick leave reasons that Mary Lou talked about, employers with less than 50 employees cannot be exempted from that under the statute. And the exemption is only if it would jeopardize the viability of the business as a going concern. So employers were saying, what does this actually mean? The DOL question and answer came out yesterday and talked briefly about the small business exemption. What they suggested is that you document that why the business meets the criteria, and even that you could start gathering that information now, but they have not said specifically what that information is going to be or what the criteria is. The DOL said not to send any materials to them now, and when that first appeared in the question and answer, it was in regular print. When I logged in to look at it this morning, it is now in bold, which means that people must have been sending things to the DOL. So I anticipate that it will include documentation such as maybe the number of – it's certainly going to be the number of employees you have and how you got to that number, and things like maybe financial documents and statements showing that this would be too burdensome for you to meet this. I did want to mention here, too, that the statute itself exempts employers smaller than 50 employees from civil damages in FMLA litigation. So what that means is that you get a small break here as well. But I'm sure it's things like front pay, back pay, potential liquidated damages for people that they would otherwise be able to cover under the statute. And as Mary Lou said, the DOL has said that they are not going to take strict enforcement of this either for the first 30 days or so as well. So there's more to come on the small business exemption in the regulations, or at least we anticipate that from the DOL. So what sort of notice are you entitled to for emergency FMLA? The new statute does not address that at all. It does not include whether you could get a medical certification or a note from a serious healthcare from a healthcare provider. What it does is just entitle people to this new piece of leave. We do not know if the DOL will clarify this, but we think, as Mary Lou talked, that it's going to be a relaxed standard. And you can refer for her slide for what may or may not be acceptable as we find out more from the DOL. It is unclear if they will actually address it. Employees are supposed to give you as much notice as possible. And the statute does say that you can require them to follow your regular call-out procedures and notify you for multiple-day absences. So you want to make sure that if you have something in place, that your employees know that they have to follow those call-out procedures. So as I was saying before, healthcare providers and emergency first responders, the DOL can issue regulations to exempt those people from the statute, meaning that they would not be able to take leave under either the paid sick leave or the FMLA that now exists, or the emergency FMLA, for any of the reasons outlined. There is also this interesting language in the statute that says employers of healthcare providers and emergency first responders can exempt such employees as well. So if the DOL does not address it, based on our reading of that language, as I was talking about before, it says that employers who employ healthcare providers can exempt such employee. We hope that there will be some guidance on this to, one, define healthcare provider, and also clarify, as I was speaking about before, whether it will be an entire workforce that can be exempted or just individual employees. So you should watch for that. We hope the DOL regulation will define these terms, but if they don't, we believe that the current FMLA definitions will control. And under the current FMLA definitions, there is a healthcare provider definition, and not surprisingly, it covers doctors and dentists, but it also covers people like clinical social workers and nurse practitioners and Christian Science practitioners, as well as some other persons. So if that controls, that is the regulations you should look at, but we anticipate that the DOL will have some type of definition in their regulations that are expected in April of 2020. So what about job restoration? So as Mary Lou said, this is job-protected leave. You can't retaliate against someone or discriminate against them as a result of this leave. So the normal FMLA restoration rules apply to most of the employers. But if you are an employer that is smaller than 25, The restoration rules that are under the current FMLA don't apply if the position does not exist due to economic conditions or other damages and operating conditions because of two factors that affect employment and are caused by the public health emergency during the period of the employee's leave. You also have to make reasonable efforts to return the person to an equivalent position. So if you meet the first factor, if you have under 25 employees, and you know their job is gone because of the public health emergency and there was some effect on employment during that period, you have to make reasonable efforts to restore them to an equivalent position. We suggest that you document those reasonable efforts, as we expect that something like this may be subject to litigation down the line. And after that, so let's say you can't reinstate someone to an equivalent position, you have to contact the employee for a period of 1 year if an equivalent position becomes available. And that 1 year is either measured from the date which leave concludes or 12 weeks after the date the leave starts. I've seen a lot of questions about what happens if there is a layoff or termination before or even after April 2nd. We think that as of right now, the statute does not cover people who have been separated from employment under one of those factors, in particular the people who have been separated before. But you're going to see FMLA claims for things like retaliation and interference. And what I mean by that is that if you laid off a bunch of people tomorrow, they could say, well, my employer did this because they didn't want me to be able to take that leave. That would be an FMLA interference claim. Or if it's after April 2nd and you have to make, or April 1st, and you have to make decisions about laying someone off, they're going to say, well, that is to interfere with my right or retaliate against me because I took this leave or wanted to take this leave. So remember that, like all layoffs and reductions in force and terminations, you're going to have to be able to articulate your legitimate, non-discriminatory reasons for making that decision. And I just wanted to touch briefly here about tax credits, as I've seen some questions about that, and then we will get some questions. So this money is coming out of your pocket as an employer, but you're going to get it back. So the IRS has issued some guidance about this, saying that you are entitled to a refundable tax credit equal to 100% of the qualified paid sick leave and FMLA pay that you give. Notice that they use the word qualified, though. So if someone is not qualified and you give it, you are not going to get a tax credit. So you can recoup them immediately by keeping a portion of the deposit that you would otherwise have to pay in certain federal, Social Security, and Medicare taxes. But if that is not enough to cover what you paid out, you can apply for an immediate check from the IRS, and the IRS expects that they will be able to process those requests in 2 weeks or less. The expedited process is supposed to be announced sometime late this week or early next week. I have not technically seen it as of yet. So we just wanted to give you this slide about how to stay informed. We have blogs that we update fairly regularly. They talk about various topics, including this one now, so that's the link to those. We also send out client e-alerts, so if you are a client or have registered for those some other way, you should be getting those as well about important topics. We are also on Twitter and have some LinkedIn groups and a company page where we're also posting some off the information that's not necessarily going on the blog, but for an e-alert, but is important for employers to know as well. And so I wanted to open it up and see if people have any specific questions, and we will try to answer those.
Hi, Amelia. I will jump in here because while you've been speaking, I've seen some questions that are common amongst the listeners. One is whether this earned sick leave is above and beyond other sick leave available to employees, and that it is, even if you have a very generous sick leave policy, these 80 hours of sick leave are available and the employee has the right to take them first before they take any other sick leave. Another question and that I've seen from several people is, if an employee uses this leave or one of these leaves, can they make up the difference by using their by using their accrued benefits? I believe it's our opinion that yes, they can. Yes, I think they can. Amelia, do you disagree?
No, I agree with that. I think they can top off their time by using their regular benefits.
Another question that was multiple people asked, if someone is staying home, they can work remotely, but they're not able to work remotely, even though they have access because they are caring for a child, do they qualify? And the answer is yes, they do qualify, even if they have the actual ability to work remotely due to having the connection or whatever it may be, having work they can take home. But they cannot do that because they need to care for children. They do qualify for the leave, and that's true. If another parent's at home, I know the question is, are both parents staying home to take care of the children? Can they do that? I guess it would be difficult to prove that that wasn't the case. I think you're going to have to some extent take your employee's word for it that they are the caregiver, but it's a gray area. There's questions also about – oh, go ahead.
I saw a question about if someone furloughs or lays off people before April 1st, do they still get that leave, the FMLA leave and the paid sick? You know, we think that those people are separated. They're also out. You know, maybe you're going to call an unpaid leave of absence. Those people are out due to lack of work. And so we think that that would not be a covered reason for them to take this. Now, if businesses open up again and these employees come back and then someone needs to take the leave for a qualifying reason, they would then get that leave.
And so keep in mind the reason that they're out of work. If they're out of work because you've laid them off already, then they're not out of work due to one of these reasons that we talked about. Prior to April 1, you can implement any policies that you already have. You don't have to comply with any of the laws we've been talking about today. So you can follow your own policies, or if there are any other applicable laws, if an employee is out for a reason that would be covered under the Mass Earned Sick Leave Act, or they'd be eligible for regular FMLA, those are the things that you would implement. Okay.
So I saw kind of an administrative question about how you should process this pay as sick leave. That is going to be kind of an individual business question and how you code that time, but it's going to be really important that you do that because you are going to have to show the IRS what you paid out in this time under both the emergency FMLA and the paid sick leave provision. You also want to make sure that you are keeping track of that, but otherwise it is going to be processed just through your normal payroll, that pay that they are going to get.
Question is it 80 hours per reason or 80 hours total? It's 80 hours total.
I see a question about if you're a tax-exempt organization, how you are going to get your money back. And the answer to that question that I have is that I do not know because we do not specialize in tax. And so what we've been encouraging our clients to do is contact their accountant and their tax attorney and find out how they will be able to recover their money.
Regarding employees who choose to stay home as they're uncomfortable coming to work because of the risks, but they don't meet any of the criteria that we've outlined, so what are employers supposed to do? I've had a few questions of that today and just over the past couple of weeks. Well, you can follow your regular policies and procedures. Is it considered an unexcused absence? One issue that I want to bring to your attention, though, is the possibility that if someone has, an anxiety disorder or a serious health condition, a disability, that in which case they're asking for a reasonable accommodation of providing time off now because of their anxiety due to the situation, you may have to provide that accommodation. So that scenario would not fall within these laws, but it might be something that you have to allow. Again, not for every employee who says they're anxious, but for an employee whose level, her mental health rises to the level of a disability.
I see a question about the 50 employee exemption or under 50 employees. What the statute says and what the question and answer said yesterday is that small businesses will be able to apply for an exemption, so small is less than 50 employees, in limited circumstances. And if you meet that criteria, the only portions of this new statute that you will be exempted from is providing the paid sick leave when someone has to be out for a child care reason, and providing the emergency FMLA leave, which is for that single reason of being out because of lack of child care. So the rest of the provisions, including the five other reasons why you can take paid sick leave, stay intact. And as written right now, no employer under 50 can be exempted from those pieces of it. I also saw a question about if you're paying employees for time in March, let's say your pay period closes on March 31st, but the check is issued on April 3rd or 4th, whether that pay is going to count. I actually have not seen any guidance on that issued either, but I anticipate that it is probably based on work week. And rather than paycheck date, which would mean that I think that it may not count because the employee was paid through March 31st, there has been, the statute isn't in effect then. But Mary Lou can tell you if she disagrees with me.
I agree with you that time would not be, it would not be considered the time under these statutes, because it's only time taken after April 1st or on or after April 1st.
One other question I've seen a lot is when someone is caring for an individual under that sick leave reason, whether it has to be a relative or not. And under a previous version of this statute, it was more specific. I believe it did refer to a family member, but it was changed to individual. And as far as I know, I was just fingering through the bill here, I have not seen any definition of individual. So unless the DOL clarifies that, that may be read pretty broadly.
There were a few questions about unemployment and if an employee uses up all leave available to them and they still cannot return to work due to child care issues, can they be eligible for unemployment? My answer is likely yes. So you should advise your employees to apply, whether it's for a layoff, a furlough, a reduction in hours, and they should apply for benefits, unemployment benefits. Okay, we've kind of gone beyond our time. Amelia, do you see other questions?
I think that we got to the majority of them, although I'm sure that we missed some. So I did see one that popped up really early on that I wanted to talk about briefly, and the question was if someone is out on this paid FMLA leave collecting 2/3, whether they could also collect unemployment. And the answer to that is that the jury is still out. So unemployment in some instances can be collected when someone has a significant reduction in hours and there is some calculation that the DUA applies to that and some rules that they apply to it. But with these new emergency DUA regulations that came out, I don't think it's perfectly clear that they would be able to do that or not. But I wouldn't be surprised if employees don't start applying for that to kind of make up some of the salary difference.
And you should be aware that there are some new unemployment guidelines related specifically to Corona situation and a little bit more generous than we may have seen in the past, but one of the things is people may not necessarily have to be available and looking for work to collect unemployment. So just keep that in mind. You can go on the Massachusetts website, the government website, mass.gov, and look at the new provisions related to unemployment claims during this time period, including the 1 week waiting period is going to be waived.
So I think that it looks like we got to the majority of the questions that we could. I know you probably still have some lingering questions, and this is a lot to digest. As I said early on, we are going to send out a copy of the slides to everyone who was registered, so you will have those as well. I encourage you to keep an eye on our blogs. Our colleague Erica is writing something about the emergency DUA regulations that will be posted in the very near future, and so those will be important for you to reference as well. And we'll just keep you apprised of other updates as they become available. So I will turn it over to Mary Lou to kind of close this out.
Okay. Well, I think, as Amelia said, we've covered the majority of questions. If you have further questions, certainly give us a call or email us. You know, it's a complicated situation, and we're still waiting for additional information. As we were preparing for this presentation today, we thought it was possible that last minute we were going to have more information to discuss with you. But keep on the lookout for additional webinar announcements. I think we're going to have another one next week on a specific topic. Again, if you have something that you'd like us to cover between now in the webinar, please feel free to email us, and we'll, to the extent possible, try to include it in the upcoming presentation. But other than that, everyone stay safe, and thank you for your attention today.